RC. What's going on, people? And go Hawks, right? Tis the day. It's finally here. Hey, before I get started, though, I want to give a big shout out, a big hand to all the people who serve on our setup and teardown crews, all right? They, every single week, they are pulling stuff in, pulling stuff out, setting things up, making it happen so that we can all enjoy God's presence together and our kids can do their ministry down there and enjoy God down there. And so, again, I'm just personally so appreciative of all of you who take the time to do that, because we know that that is a tough thing. You're getting up early on a Sunday. You're getting out of here later than everybody else. And so I'm just personally so grateful for what you do. So thank you so much for all of that. You guys are huge, all of you. So thank you so much. We have some ground to cover today, and so I'm going to make sure we get right to business. So let's go ahead and pray together. We're going to solicit Jesus to be among us today to teach us and kind of open up our hearts and minds to what he has. And so let's go ahead and do that together. Jesus, I thank you for the goodness of your word. I thank you for the fact that it reminds us of what is true. It reminds us of what to do, especially when life is crazy, you know, and even what we're looking at today is so much about that. In fact, that's what I love about all of these different play tracks in this playlist of the Psalms. It just reminds us of kind of the bare essentials of what it means to be able to live in this life in a way that is faithful to you. And from that secures us. I mean, even the songs we were singing this morning were so good for my own soul. It's just as far as saying, man, we carry a lot of pain that we don't need to. We carry a lot of burden that is self kind of stacked on as opposed to giving it to you. And so I pray that even today as we go through this particular song, that it will remind us of where we cast such things and that we will look to you. And so again, I thank you so much for your grace and goodness and love toward us. And I pray for your peace over our lives today. We thank you and we praise you in your perfect name. Amen. So I was reflecting on culture a lot this week. It's probably one of my hobbies. I don't mean to, but I think my brain is just wired to do that. And especially as I'm looking at God's word, there's always just this comparison going on. And if I really kind of step back for a minute, I would say that what is true is that things have changed when it comes to being a Christian within the American kind of populace that are very different than 15 years ago, right? Things just sort of change quickly in a lot of ways. So if we were to jump in our DeLorean, go back in time 15 years, we would see that being a Christian in the American population was different in that many people would have considered themselves to be Christian just 15 years ago. It would have been the assumption that, hey, if you're American, you're Christian because our forefathers were all Christian people. I mean, that was sort of the assumption of the day, right? And even from that, there was a branding of Christians, which were, they were the moral majority. And most of our neighbors and friends would share fundamentally the same type of ethical worldview when it came to certain topics in life. And if your family member or your child went to church or youth group, they were maybe seen more as kind of goodies or squares, do-gooders, that kind of thing, Bible thumpers. But that was their category, right? Even by those who maybe disagreed, that was still the category. But in the last 15 years, things have accelerated in all sorts of ways. So much so that now, if you have parents with a teenager that are not churched people, they're not Christian, they don't do that, and they find out that their teenager wants to start going to a Christian youth group, instead of it being, hey, this is probably good, clean fun, they're more apt to be concerned. That may be a harmful or a dangerous thing to them from a social or psychological perspective. So that's a shift. And where, again, we used to share the same morals culturally, nowadays, those who are of the non-Christian persuasion are increasingly a larger category. In fact, there's this whole group in the sciences now that we call the nuns. They check the nun box on what your religious affiliation is. And so that's shifting too. The nuns are getting larger. They're disaffiliating from what they used to say 15 years ago, which is, well, I'm an American, I'm a Christian. Now they say, none of the above. I'm not anything. And they're more open to do that. on the shared ethic, increasingly, the majority now would say we have different views on marriage and divorce and sex outside of marriage. And some of the things that we all used to kind of agree on, they've changed. And where Christians used to be seen as the do-gooders, now they're maybe seen a little bit more as judgmental or biased or even hateful at times for maybe holding certain historic positions and orthodoxies and matters of ethics that pertain to various topics of the day. So all of that has sort of happened in the last 15 years. I mean, it's accelerated quickly. And there's a lot of reasons why people assume this has been the case. In fact, just this week, there was an article in the Washington Post that was fascinating to me. And the whole kind of thesis of the article was looking at Christians that are kind of leaving the faith, in particular millennials that are checking the nun box and kind of just walking out of it. And they're asking the question, what is the biggest contributor to the secularization of younger Christians? And when they distilled it all down, they said, it's not science, it's not sociology. Fundamentally, secularization among younger Christians is coming because of one topic, sex. Sex. They said more and more, they're venturing out into areas of sexuality that are, in essence, secularizing them. And it doesn't surprise me because I look and I go, over the last 15 years, the internet has permeated more homes, the speed of the internet's become more rapid, and the things that you can find out there are increasingly more concerning. And all of that is functioning as an educator and a stimulator and an area of interest. So it's no surprise to me that I look around and I say, man, being a Christian today is probably a little bit more challenging than it was 15 years ago, certainly than it was 25 years ago. Now, having said all of that, this is nothing new for the Christian. Nothing new. There have been many seasons in the history of Christianity and many seasons in the history of Israel, right? But the kind of the proto-church of Israel. There's always been seasons and times where the culture around us was different than us. Nothing new. And right now, it is not nearly as bad as sometimes that it's been before. And so the question that we're wrestling with today is, what do we do? What do we do in light of that? What are responses that are healthy and good and building? And what are responses that are harmful and destructive and are not going to bring out God's best in our lives? Because again, there can be a lot of responses to the reality of our day. So we want to understand what are the best responses to navigate this. And so today, because of that, we are looking at this next track in the playlist of David, Dave's playlist, which is Psalm 37. So if you have a Bible, you can go to Psalm 37. If you have our Bible app, we have our notes inside the app. You can follow along with those notes. Verses are all there. You can fill in the blanks. It's a great tool to use, or you can use your own Bible app if you want. But again, Psalm 37 is the place that we are going. And we're not going to go through the whole thing today. We're just going to hit some select things because Psalm 37 keeps repeating itself in different ways. I think in part because, again, like I keep saying, these different lyrics are emotional, right? It's pouring out one's heart in the context of the problems or hardships or joys of life. And so, again, sometimes you're saying the same thing over and over just to kind of embed it into your life. And so that's what it is. And so these are lyrics by David. And it's a season in his life where he's looking around at life and saying, you know, those who don't believe the faith that I believe, those who are a bit more carefree in the things of life, even some of which may be doing things that are truly improper and not glorifying to God, he's looking at those people and saying, you know what, they seem to be getting away with it. They seem to have lives that are easier than my life. They seem to not honor God, and yet in honoring God, they're getting ahead. They seem to have more fun. They seem to be more approved of. They seem to have greater ease. Everybody around them seems much more affirming of this. And so he's looking at this and saying, man, this is a challenge when the world has shifted and you try to honor God and everything around you doesn't want to honor God, and yet that seems to be the better way forward from a practical point of view. What do you do when that happens? Maybe that's some of you. right? Where you turn on the radio or turn on the television or you go online or whatever you're doing, you're reading a magazine, a book, a newspaper, if anybody still reads those, right? And you see things and you go, wait, how is it that there's so many things in our world that are celebrated, that are grievous to God, and it seems like those who want to honor God are more shoved to the background? What do you do in that? Well, here's the way this opens up that is so pertinent to us because it deals with the two different ways we may tend to react in those seasons. And I think this is going to be valuable for us today to walk through, right? Two different reactions. And so in your notes, it starts off with this first thing. When that happens, when the world is like that, neither worry about nor want the world. When the world seems to go one direction, contrary to God, and you're kind of caught in the middle of all of that, neither worry about nor want the world. Verse 1, fret not. Fret not yourself because of the evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers. Now, when life is like this, when you feel like life is kind of unfair in connection to what you believe, there's a whole cornucopia of responses we can have. But when you look at this, it really boils down to two. And I think that's pretty accurate. That there's usually just these two polar opposites that can happen in our lives. And I want to say this up front. Both of these things are equally dangerous just for different reasons. But both are dangerous. So what you can do, one response, is when the world shifts and you go, this isn't fair, you get angry. That's what it means to fret, to get angry. The other is that you go, I want to affirm what's happening. I'm going to join up with. So anger or affirmation are both equally broken just for different reasons. And so we have to be aware of both. And both are, like I said, they're tempting to do, to be angry at those around you who seem to be getting away with stuff, or to then say, I affirm those who are getting away with it, so my life is easier. Both are super easy to do. I remember this back in elementary school. It goes way back to then. See, I remember in elementary school that at recess, there was always the cliques. Before high school, we were doing this in elementary school, like fourth grade, man. There was cliques. And I remember the girls' clique out on the playground. The center of that clique was Rachel, right? Rachel was like the hub of the clique, and all the other girls wanted to be like Rachel. All the other girls wanted to be around Rachel. Rachel was the coolest. Now, Rachel wasn't nice. Rachel, if you're watching, you weren't nice. But Rachel was cool. And if you wanted to fit in, you just had to affirm Rachel. Even though Rachel would sometimes, you know, kind of kick you out of the group for a week just to kind of let you know she was the one in charge, right? You would come into the group and Rachel would be like, no, leave, right? And it'd be like, all right, you know. But then a week later, she'd be like, all right, show your mercy, come back in, right? So that's what she did. And so you just had to affirm if you wanted to be in the group. And so people just learned to affirm Rachel where she was at, no matter what. But you could be in the group. But then what happened one day? Lynn moved to town. Right? And poor Lynn, she's not trying to do anything, but it just happens to be that Lynn was cuter, Lynn was nicer, and suddenly that whole cluster around Rachel went, Lynn seems awesome. And then that group that was around Rachel had to make decisions, right? And some were like, wait, we like Lynn better. Now we're going to be angry at Rachel for being so mean to all of us. And others were like, no, we got to affirm Rachel because again, Lynn, she just got here. We don't know about her. She's not cool at all. We want, you know, and there was this thing. So everybody had to decide between anger or affirmation, Lynn or Rachel, right? Nobody ever thought about some other option. It's all the same. Oddly enough, everybody went over to Lynn. Everybody ditched Rachel, and suddenly she became nice, right? And eventually Lynn was like, Rachel seems cool, let's add her. And then there was a power struggle after that. It was great. So, but see, that's the tension. Anger. Or affirmation. And that's what we have to work through too, because like I said, both are problematic for different reasons. And so if you look at to fret, which literally in Hebrew means to burn, right? To be frustrated by or to be heated up. You have to look and say, what are the things that kind of burn me up inside? And by the way, when we say this anger thing, I don't want you to think that it's just like DEFCON 1 anger. Anger's got a spectrum, right? You can have subtle anger, or you can have like flipping out, extra hot salsa, burn your face off anger, right? So there's this whole spectrum of anger. But the response of that is what we want to be aware of, that that's a dangerous place to be. So for example, us as Christians, I'm only speaking to us as Christians. If we as Christians look at our neighbors who are atheists and they make us angry, that's not a healthy place to be. If we look at our Muslim neighbors and they make us angry, that is not the place to be. If we look at Black Lives Matter and it makes us angry, that's not the place to be. If you look at the white supremacists and it just makes you angry, that is not the place to be. You can go through the list. If you look at really conservative people politically and they make you angry, that is not the place to be. If you look at hyper-liberals and they make you angry, that's not the place to be. You can fill in the blank. You look at a Patriots fan, that's a tough one, but it's not the place to be. Especially after Thursday, you just feel bad for them, right? This is why I say anger is unhealthy, right? It's unhealthy. And I know sometimes as Christians we say, but there's righteous anger. And I say, yes, but I've almost never seen it displayed by us who are Christians. Almost never. I think it's just our anger and then we throw righteous on it to feel better, right? Like, now I'm being godly for being angry, you know, and I'm ranting and yelling at the television. Righteous, right? No, it's just angry. It's just angry. And now here it says evildoers. And I listed a whole list of things. I could have kept listing more. People with power, people with money, people, any number of things that we can be angry at. And a lot of those things that I listed don't necessarily have a bunch of evildoers running them. That's not my point. But my point is sometimes the opposition does cast everybody as evildoers if it's the opposition. You just turn on, again, the news, and one channel is going to put the other group in this vilified category, kind of making it sound like everybody on the other side is evil of whatever I believe. And yet, even if they are evil, David says, don't be angry, don't fret, just chill, right? It's easy to become angry, but it's not helpful to do so, right? It's not Christ's agenda to do so. I'm pretty sure when Jesus said, love your enemies, he actually meant love your enemies, right? To not justify the frustration. Now, that does not mean that we're not there to bring a counter voice in love, in kindness, in grace to certain things. But it's going, we're dealing with the inside, the internals of it, that our thing towards somebody that we may have a disagreement with is saying, I want to stay tender in my heart to that person. I want to love on that person, even in the disagreement. As soon as it comes down to, they're an idiot. They're stupid. They don't know what they're doing. And salsa goes up. That's when we go, oh, now I've crossed over into a sin. And that's not going to solve anything. And so we want to run from the fret. Because I get it, it's going to be easy to say, well, why do they get away with it? How come nobody sees their hypocrisy in this? They're not consistent. You ever say that to yourself? These people are never consistent, right? We all say that. And here's what's funny. No one's consistent. Everybody's a hypocrite. We can just come out and say that. I don't care where you at. I love the Bible. I love Jesus. And I'm a hypocrite. I don't always fulfill it. Al Gore, he's an environmentalist who hops on airplanes all the time. Burns tons of jet fuel to tell you about how we shouldn't burn jet fuel, right? Has the best of intentions, but is hypocritical. Right? Everybody's a hypocrite. Everybody is. And that's why all the more it's like, man, I shouldn't be angry about hypocrisy as much as I go, man, it's a part of the human condition. We're all broken. We need somebody to step in and fix our broken condition. Thank you, Jesus. Right? And so we shouldn't get trapped into all of those things. It just breeds our anger, right? So don't let it chap your hide, whatever that means. Don't get chapped in the hide, right? Don't be angry. But equally it says, don't be envious. And that is the other place. And sadly, as a pastor, I see A, I've been tempted to that in my history. And B, I see fellow Christians who are increasingly tempted to saying, if you can't beat them, join them. Well, let's just move the borders of our beliefs. Let's just affirm, let's accommodate, let's say, yeah, that's what it used to say, but I'm gonna move that out so now it kind of fits the new current model, right? And so that can happen just as easily where we start to look and say, you know, as, I know the Bible says that, but you know, if the Bible writers kept writing and they were writing today, they wouldn't say that. And we just assume they would say it different. And some in the Christian community, that's kind of what they've done with that. Or we look and say, God can't be that strict. He's a God of grace. He's a God of mercy. He's a God of kindness and love. And so therefore, all this stuff about what he calls people to, it doesn't count. And we start to soften it up that way. Or we start to buy the narrative that most Christians are kind of judgmental jerks. That's right. Most Christians are judgmental jerks. Listen, I know a lot of Christians. Most are not judgmental jerks. There are a couple. You probably know who you are, right? But the huge majority of Christians that I know are trying to figure out how to thread the needle of grace and truth and compassion in their culture, and they're loving people where they're at. I'm increasingly finding that evangelical Christians are actually some of the nicest people in culture because they feel so watched as being judgmental and unaccepting. Again, every once in a while, some news station will roll out our crazy drunk uncle for Jesus that says dumb stuff, right? Right? That's true. But I don't think that's the majority. So we don't want to buy that narrative and say, you know what? That's right. I'm going to distance myself from that minority stereotype, even though it doesn't reflect the majority of what is real among Christians. Right? And so we don't want to just accommodate and say, yep, I'll change the borders, I'll change the rules, I'll say the Bible doesn't count anymore, or certain parts of the Bible don't count anymore, and start to envelop other ideas. Or to start looking at our lives and saying, man, if I take my faith really seriously, that's going to demand a lot of me, and I'd rather have my freedom and flexibility. This is another way it happens. Our accommodation isn't necessarily ideological as much as it's practical. I'd rather keep my money so I don't give. I'd rather have my Sunday so I don't come, right? I'd rather not feel confronted so I don't listen. Right? And that's another way that we can accommodate. And so in both of these camps, when the world is kind of going sideways, David says, don't get angry and don't become accommodating. You don't want to go to those places because both of those are short-sighted to the big picture. In fact, in verse 2, he says it this way. Those who are evildoers, those who are wrong, and those who go down these roads of being angry or affirming of that, they will soon fade like the grass, and they will wither like the green herb. You say that in Washington State, like herb. Huh? He said herb. Like I said, it's easy to be tempted to anger. It's easy to be tempted to affirmation, and both of those are tempting us to sin, and we want to fight that because, again, if we go down that road, it ends like what your lawn looks like now, right? Seattle lawns in September, withered, dead, unless you're cool enough to have a sprinkler, right? And so the heart here is clear. It means you just want to fast forward to the end what this looks like. If you choose to be angry at everything in our culture that you say is contrary to Christ, and anger is your gearing, the end of that is you're going to have a very unhappy life. Very unhappy life. You're just going to be angry all the time. And equally, if you go down the road that says, no, I'm just going to be affirming of everything, I guarantee you, in the end, you're going to have an unfulfilled life. It's not going to lead you into the riches of the depths of the joy of Christ. It's just not going to take you there. It's going to be a constant strain to try to get filled up by something else. And so both of those are miserable places to be. Because ultimately, it's an oscillating of different kinds of sins that rob us of peace and purpose and a sense of joy. So David says, avoid frustration, avoid fascination with the world. And he says, instead, I want you to convert to focus and I want you to convert to faith. In other words, to invest into living well in the world. In your notes, it means invest to live well in the world. It means don't avoid the world. Don't look away from the world. Rather, look up to Christ. And from this, David's going to give a series of proactive movements that we need to engage in. So again, we can't just say to ourselves, verse one, I won't be angry and I won't affirm. I'm just going neutral, right? He says, no, neutral isn't enough. Neutral means you'll drift into some gear that takes you one or two ways. So you have to replace the propensity for those things with something proactive. And so it's in that spirit that he begins to list a series of things. The first is this. He says, trust in the Lord. That's where he opens up. Trust in the Lord. In other words, believe God is actually in control. Especially when it's rough. Believe he's in control. So let me tell you what stinks to be a pastor. Here's what stinks. You sit down to go through a psalm. You're reading Psalm 37. You're mapping out your message. Everything else, you come to this little section, trust in the Lord. And you go, great, here's my little pithy statement that's bumper sticker worthy that everybody can go, yes, that's so good. That's awesome. That'd be great. And then your world comes apart by Thursday. And now your pithy little thing that's meant to inspire better become real or you're full of it. Well, that's my life. Right? And so this becomes part announcement too. This is great. It grounds real life with the passage. So on Thursday, we get together with our architect and our builder and wetland study specialist and city, kind of a planner person with the city and some of us, and we all go into the city and say, hey, we have this building down on 203. We have this vision for it where we wanna use the parking for this and the building for that, and we exist for the good of the city, and we wanna get underway with this, and we wanna start the building permit process and everything else, but we wanna understand what the challenges are gonna be with this, right? But we're here for the city. And they say, well, and we kind of knew some of this, but they said, here's what's going on. The city's been growing really quickly. And a lot of people in the city don't love necessarily the speed of the growth. And it's created different challenges. And so the city council is going to vote on new measures in the city that restrict building. And part of that is going to be connected to wetlands. And your building just happens to be next door to a wetland. And right now, how far you are is fine. But when we vote this in December, it's going to expand that massively. And your entire building will be inside a wetland buffer. And when that happens, you can't do anything with your building during that time. As long as that is the standard, you won't be able to do anything with that. Right? And so here we come in going, we want to be for the good of the city. And then we hear kind of what the city says, this is going to be good for us in the future. And we're like, pfft. Right? And so I leave that meeting and my mind is reeling. And I'm like, can we get all the permitting in by December 5th? And then we got the list of all the things that would have to happen, traffic surveys and soil samples and water runoff, and all these things. And our architect and our builder said, if we had 8 months to do all of that, we could, but 3 months is not possible. We just couldn't get it in that amount of time. Now, you might be able to do this thing here, and we're trying to figure out some things right now. And so welcome to the announcement. And so I take all that in and leave, and I'm walking down Main Street. And I could look at this any number of ways and say, oh, this is just the enemy. This is just whatever, it's politics. I could do any number of things. But see, here's what sucks. Oh, it sucks. It sucks. Psalm 37, one sucks. Don't fret. Don't be angry. Don't accommodate. Don't get all worked up. What's it say? It says, trust in the Lord. Wow, you mean I actually have to practice this? Have to practice? We have to practice this now as a church? We have to trust in the Lord? But see, here's what's funny. You just sang about it about a half an hour ago, and it was fine when you were singing it. Lest the Lord builds the house, we labor in vain. We're like, oh, that's so deep and good. Now you're like, oh, unless the Lord builds this house, we're going to labor in vain. You know, like, but isn't that the thing? I mean, isn't that the whole idea, right? That God's like, hey, do you think I don't have this handled? Do you think you bought that building and bought that property and I didn't know there was a wetland there? Dude, I put that wetland there, right? You think I didn't know what was going on in the hearts and minds of the people of Duval to know that the city council might want to change an ordinance? In effect, do you think I didn't know that? And then I go further down the road and he's like, hey man, do you remember there was this time, it was like 6 years ago, you guys needed to start a church, you did it in 7 days and I pulled that off for you and you're worried now, you dunce Boswell, right? 2 weeks ago, I was just praying and had my own internal dumb going on there was this thing where it's like, I'm not gonna say it was audible, but it was so clear in my heart and spirit when I was just wrestling with building things, knowing that we were gonna have this meeting with the city and knowing there's some of these challenges and everything else. And I'm like, God, you know, I don't know what to do and I don't know what you want me to do and everything else. And it was real simple. He says, I want you to do this. I want you to be pure. I want you to stick around and watch what I do. It was that simple. Be pure, stick around, watch what I do. Now, do I know what that is? No clue. I have no clue, man. No idea what he's gonna do. I don't know if he'll move in the heart of the city council. I don't know if the ordinance will change. I don't know if it'll be some crazy circus. I don't know what it is. I have no idea. If somebody said, well, what's our plan? Trust in God, that's my plan. It's all I got. It's Sunday, I found out Thursday, it's what I got. The elders haven't even had a chance to meet about it yet. All right, that's tomorrow night. But that's what I know we can do. We can trust God. And then more than that, it says, trust God and do what? It says, and do good. Do good means I don't get angry. I don't try to figure out how can I manipulate things and go, well, you know, we have a large voting base at Redemption Church. Maybe the city council needs to know we have a large voting base. You know, like, right? Like, that's stupid. As far as it's not me trying to do good, it's me trying to figure out how do I manipulate the system? How do I get in there? And, you know, do good. Why are we here as a church? For the good of the city. We're here for the good of the city, right? How do we act as encouragements to the city? How do we build up the city? How do we love on the city? And if this is where the city happens to be going at this time, great. God, how do you have us do this? How do we focus on the welfare of where you've placed us? We're just gonna keep doing good. We're not gonna try to manipulate. We're not gonna pout. Because at the end of the day, we're not called to be successful as Christians. We're just called to be faithful. Right? We're not called to be successful. We're called to be faithful. We're called to act in ways that Jesus would have us act. So this is a great opportunity. It's not easy. It's not pleasant, but I don't think this ever said it was going to be easy or pleasant. It's just the opportunity. What he then goes on to say because of this is dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. I love that being the next thing because here's what David was tempted to do. He was tempted to split. Right? Life is bad. The environment here is bad. So if we just kind of take up our stakes from our tent, go to another place, plant them, it's going to be good. And he says, no. I want you to dwell. I want you to stay. And I want you to make being faithful your friend. I think even for us as a church, we can look and go, man, are we going to be able to stay in Duval? And people from the get-go, when we looked at going outside to Duval, said, no, we feel led to stay in Duval. So we're like, great. We feel led to stay in Duval. I'm just kind of practicalizing this right now, but I go, great. Are we going to continue to be faithful? Here's one of the temptations now, because we have no clear future. The people are going to go, oh, I don't know if I'm going to give to the building fund now because I don't know where it's going. No, be faithful. I don't know where it's going either, but be faithful. One day God's going to open something that we're like, hey, we need to do this, right? Hezekiah did what? He prayed and he dug wells, right? He both functioned and he sought God. So in the same way, it's like, man, I don't know what's going to happen with our future space, but I know this. We got to keep being faithful. Got to keep moving forward. Got to keep giving to the plan. Got to keep driving it until God says, here's what you're going to do different. Lack of faithfulness would be like, oh, wash our hands, wait till we die. That's not what we're going to do. We're going to be faithful. We're going to stick around. I would say that also is just Christians in general, right? That we should look at wherever God has planted us and say, I'm going to be faithful and stick around. I know there's some of us that say, you know what, man, I am so tired of living in liberal Washington. I just want to go to Idaho where there's the United States of America. Right? And there's some of us that say, I am so tired of living around lukewarm liberals. Vermont, feel the burn. Can't wait to get to Vermont, right? And so, yet God says, I want you to focus, right? It's so easy to say the grass is greener on the other side. No, the grass is greener where you water it, right? It's greener where you water it. And so it's so easy to say my life is difficult right now, and if I just change the environment, my life's going to get easier. No, you water it where you're at. Grass is never greener on the other side. If you get over there and you don't water it, it dies there too, right? Dies there too. And so he says, dwell and be faithful, right? That's the life goal. How do you do it? Next he says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Now this is not saying delight in God and he goes all Santa on you, right? Like, I just sing his praise and now I've got a new Tesla car. Awesome! It's not what it's saying. It's saying delight in who he is and he will begin to more and more shape the desires in you. You delight in him and he changes your heart disposition. You delight in him, he subdues your worries. You delight in him, he shapes your joys. You delight in him, he gives you a whole new sense of life purpose that you own. That's what this is really getting into. In other words, the more you focus on him, the more he shapes the real you. I want you to write that down. The more you focus on him, the more he shapes the real you. Right? And that's going to be the key to all that we're doing here. Because the more we delight in him, the more he creates endurance and calm and rescue and peace and joy. He just does that. It doesn't mean the surroundings have shifted. It just means that he's controlling the internals and the outside doesn't have as much impact on that. And so from this, David continues in verse 5, commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him and he will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. I love this. Commit means in Hebrew to roll off the back. To roll off the load, right? To take off the backpack. It's again that idea of just giving it to him. Trusting him and letting him act. So in my case, like I said, for example, with the building, it's saying, all right, God, I can take this backpack as far as humanly I know how to take it. Now I've got to roll this off my back. I've got to give it to you. I've got to commit it to you, trust you, and let you act. I don't know what that looks like, but that's what I need to do. And there's a lot of other areas I need to do that as well. I have to do that with my wife. I have to do that with my kids. I have to do that with career or money or health or cultural conditions. Whatever it is, I have to say, you know what? There are so many things really outside of my control. And the more I want to try to take control, the more I just create burdens for myself because I don't have control. And so I need to just roll it off the back, trust in God, and let him act. I got to stop worrying about the times I live in. And I need to start worshiping the God who holds all my time. Right? And so David gets this and encourages this in us because he says, one day your righteousness is going to be rewarded, right? One day your plight will see justice. But that's going to be ready in due time. In due time. Doesn't mean tomorrow or next week. It doesn't mean if I go, hey, if I'm just a really good Christian then for like 3 months, everything is going to become bliss. I'm going to start singing the Lego song, everything is awesome, right? Is that what's going to happen? No, I can't guarantee that. But in due time, God will be faithful. Now, I know our temptation is, Jesus, I want it now. That's what we typically ask. Jesus, I want it now. Whatever the thing is, I want it now. And yet what our prayer needs to be is, Jesus, be enough for me for now. Be enough for me for now. This is probably why he says in verse 7, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. And then he recycles through something that's important. He says, fret not yourselves over the one who prospers in his way or the man who carries out evil desires. Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourselves. It tends only to evil. I love the pairing here, right? It's kind of like in my mind, like it's like a prime rib with like a petite Syrah. You know what I mean? It's like a pairing where he says, be still, be patient. It counters our emotional reflexes. Because when life goes crazy, we tend to overcorrect, right? Isn't that true? That's our natural tendency is overcorrection. So you're driving down the road, kids are in the back, they're watching Dora the Explorer, right? And it's loud, Dora the Explorer, yay, back, right? All that stuff's happening, right? And the dog's in the back barking, and then you find that the kids aren't enjoying, back, but they're fighting over the one bag of Cheetos you brought, and you're thinking to yourself, why did I just bring one bag of Cheetos? I should have brought two for the kids, right? And all that's happening, and then you're trying to turn up the radio so that you don't hear Dora, and you don't hear the dog and everything else, and you're looking back trying to grab the bag of Cheetos, and then you veer off the road, so what do? Boom, you overcorrect, right? Because everything's crazy, and the overcorrection is the risk. And so in the same way, we have all kinds of things in life that are like that craziness in the back, and we want to tend to overcorrect. This is why he says, don't overcorrect, rather be still and be patient. Be still means to listen, right? To let God guide, and then from that, let him act. You just got to let him guide, let him act. In other words, what we have to do, this is what I'm still learning to do, and I'm not great at it. I need to embrace God's track record and believe that's going to be true for my life. See, God's track record, I mean, you read the Bible, and consistently, God is rescuing his people. God is stepping in ways that you didn't even think possible. And if I look at my own life, there's been so many times where Ellen and I are like fretting, crying, worried, what's next? It's all going to fall apart. We're going to die, right? All that stuff. We're overcorrecting all over the road, right? Because it's crazy in the back, right? And yet every single time, it was just expounding on all of this worry. And God's like, dude, don't you know I have this handled? Like, I've always been in control. Like, I'm actually care about your life. It's going to be fine. It's like, we have to learn that God always does come through for his people. In fact, let me create a parallel for you. And it's so pertinent for today. Today is the opening day of the Seahawks, right? So let me brace you. Let me brace you. We are going to be losing realistically until the last 4 minutes of the fourth quarter, right? I'm just helping you out here. We're gonna be losing realistically to the last 4 minutes of the fourth quarter, because that's the way it always works out for us. And we're sitting there biting our nails, and we're fretting, and we're pacing, and I can't stay in here, I gotta go into the kitchen, I gotta have a drink, I gotta come back, right? We're gonna do all of that, and in the last 4 minutes, Russ drops back, pumps one down to Baldwin, he's gonna take it off the foot, the knee, the face, catch it with one hand, laying on the ground, right? And it's gonna take him down to the two, and then Rawls is gonna punch it in after like three downs. It's gonna be fourth down. Pete's like, go, we just go no matter what, right? That's gonna happen, and somehow we're gonna win. And then after the game, you know, we all say to one another, yep, that's the Seahawks win. That's how we do it every time. We're losing, and then somehow we win. That's just the Seahawks way, right? Welcome to the God way, right? It's the same deal. So often in life, it looks like you're losing, and somehow at the end, God shows up big and does big things. And we may never seem to embrace that that's how he does it, but it's how he does it every single time. God's got it covered. So what's it say? Turn away from evil and do good. So you shall dwell forever, for the Lord loves justice, and he will not forsake his saints. You just have to keep doing the next right thing. You just have to keep doing the next right thing. No matter what the next right thing is, that's what you need to keep doing. Right? You just have to believe that God is going to come through, that God is going to be big, that God is going to move and to act and to function in the way that he always does. And so from that, we need to be the God-oriented world dweller. Say that 5 times fast, I dare you. What is the God-oriented world dweller? It says, verse 30, the mouth of the righteous utters wisdom, and his tongue speaks justice. The law of God is in his heart. He does not slip. Verse 31 is the secret to verse 30. David says later in one of his great songs, Psalm 119, he says, I have hidden your word in my heart so that I don't sin against you. Jesus says something equally profound in Matthew 12. He says, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And what he means also by that is you live your life. And so both of these are saying you need to inject and embed the word of God into your heart in such a way that then it changes how you speak, how you think, what you do, how you act and react, and how you process the world around you, right? All of that is there. And so that's how we press in. We feast on and we fill our lives with truth. And from that, it reveals the God-oriented world dweller's promise in verse 34 when it says, wait for the Lord and keep his way and he will exalt you to inherit the land. Right? He says, listen for God. Don't get angry at the world. Follow after God. Don't approve of the world. And in due time, he will exalt you. It's just such a clear plan. What it also means, though, for us is that, therefore, we have to make the proactive decisions to grow in our endurance, to grow in our strength, to live out what this is talking about. Again, it is not bite down on the leather strap and just be disciplined to do it. This is about saying, no, I need to take decisions and make decisions of my life that will help me grow and be strong. And this is why, again, we keep pressing our next step pathways and all the things that are in there. We've shown this graphic about all the things we're trying to do as a church to help us grow. It's why I keep wearing the shirt week after week after week, right? It's like a McDonald's uniform now. It's like, you know, it's just like, hey, Redemption Church has got mandatory uniforms. But we're doing that because, again, we're trying to encourage all of us to say, what are the things that I need to bring into my life to help me grow more? And in this graphic, we have a couple of things that we've been pushing hard. So one is the regroups, which is our small groups, right? And we keep pushing it because, again, I know for a fact that this is where we really grow. About 30% of what we as Christians are called to do, we can do on Sunday morning. The rest really happens in our small groups. And I know there's probably some of you out there that are like, you know, dude, no matter what you say, I'm not doing a small group. I don't want to do a small group. I don't like the small groups. I'm not interested in a small group because I am an army of one. And I go, man, you're robbing yourself. Now, I know the temptation. I confess. There are parts of me at times where I'm like, man, do I want to be in a regroup? I'm just being honest. See, my regroup's on Thursday night. For me, Thursday is my Friday. It's my Friday night. So on Friday night, you like to relax, you like to wind down, you like to go out and do things. And so I could be like, man, you know, I'd rather just have that time. But you know what? It's not going to grow me. Being in a group grows me in all kinds of ways. Even grows me when I'm like, hi, I don't know if I want to go. I got other things to do. And God's like, dude, even that grows you. Because again, it's all about you at that point, and it's not about what I have for you, and it's not about how you can help others and pour into them as they pour into you. And so again, I know the temptation, but man, this is where we grow. We also have this whole idea of a foundations class, which is just to ground people in the basics of the Christian faith, which nowadays is so critical. And that's a way we can grow. And so if you want information on either one of those in our next steps, man, you can just click those boxes. Maybe for some of you, though, that's not where you're at. You need to start following Jesus for the first time in your life. You go, I have not. I've been coming to church. I've been hearing these sayings. I've been curious about deals. But you go, I haven't just said, Jesus, take my life, man. Take my life, take my sin, forgive that of me, and I want to follow you, right? I want you to handle changing the desires of my heart so that I can experience the fullness of what it is you promise. And if that's the decision where you're at, you can click that little box right there and we're going to instantly get a hold of you. Or I'm at the door after the service and I would love to hear from you and talk to you about what that means for your life. What it means to follow Jesus. Because at the end of all things, what we've been talking about through all of these Psalms and what we're going into in our next series, Built Not Born, is saying, how do we go deeper into what it means to be a faithful follower of Christ, and from that to reap the blessing and the dividends of that abundant life in him? Let's go ahead and pray together. Jesus, I thank you again for our friend David, who's just transparent, who shares his weaknesses and shares his strengths and shares his broken thinking as well as his clarity. And I just find that I relate to that. And I pray for us as a church right now, even as we have a future where from one perspective, a physical building future perspective, we go, we don't know what you have for us, but you know what? You've got us right here and you've got a plan that we don't know of, and all you call us to is to keep being faithful. to keep trusting you, to keep going, all right, I don't know what it looks like, but I know the God who handles all things and what he looks like, and that you always come through for us. Even if it's the last 4 minutes of the fourth quarter, you come through with some crazy play in our lives. So may we remember that and remember you in your name.